Fastify is a web dash API framework for Node. You typically use it to build your APIs. You can also render templates, render HTML, serve files, do web sockets. It has a good thriving community. And how it differs to other servers, it's fast. Okay, it's as fast as Node is, essentially. Like our goal is, our unattainable goal is to be zero overhead compared to Node.js. We are trying to be there at the top. We are actually very close. What you lose for the for Fastify features, it's not much. Okay, it takes a few different approaches compared to Express, which is what everybody else is using.
Hello, welcome to the DevTools FM podcast. This is a podcast about developer tools and the people who make them. I'm Andrew, and this is my co-host, Justin.
Hey, everyone. We're really excited to have Matteo on. Matteo is the founder and CTO of Platformatic, co-founder and CTO of Platformatic. Matteo, you do so many other things. It's as we're doing the bio for you, it's just like kind of crazy. Sort of the creator and primary maintainer of Fastify, which is sort of what I think of as like the modern Express replacement. You have worked on Pino, which is a really cool logger. You've got a lot of other really interesting open source projects. You're on the technical steering committee for Node. The list goes on. So we're incredibly excited to have you on. Before we dive in and start talking about specific topics, would you like to tell our listeners anything else about yourself?
A few things that you might, everybody, by the way, start with that. And first of all, let's start with saying, well, I'm also on the board of directors of the OpenJS Foundation, the home of Node.js, Fastify, Webpack, ESLint, Electron, Express, 30 other projects, Node-RED, like, I don't know, 20 other projects or something like that. It's jQuery too, jQuery, you know, you don't imagine how much time we spend in board meetings talking about jQuery. It powers the web. It's the most popular framework of the web. So you might, you know, we can talk about jQuery. This is going to be a phenomenal talk. Modern jQuery, you know, I recommend you a new show about modern jQuery in here. So, and our project in this late maturity is new. Okay, it's interesting. It's interesting just for people to know, probably. So apart from that, what else? Do I have a daughter, almost 3 years old daughter? So I don't know. I'm also a father. I don't know. I don't. That's more or less it. I have a YouTube channel and a Twitch channel now. So I'm trying to do a little bit more marketing side of things and developer marketing. Conferences, you can watch me at conferences most of the time, a few times per year. So yeah, pretty much. Yeah.
What decisions are you making about jQuery? Like, I feel, has any lines of code in jQuery changed in a while?
It does releases. Okay. Recently, the biggest one was changing the provider of the CDN. Like all the internet is maintained, is up because the OpenJS Foundation maintains the jQuery CDN, which is gently offered by a provider, and we needed to switch providers. So, and this is actually very hard because it consumes, you know, petabytes of data. So it's fun.
We'd like to thank Raycast for sponsoring our podcast. Raycast is an app for Mac that's like Spotlight, but with superpowers. Besides just quickly opening files, URLs, or apps, it provides clipboard history, window management, a schedule overview, and much, much more. And if you're interested in writing extensions for Raycast, it has a really cool, clean API. It's based on React, so if you know how to write React, you'll fit right in. You should also check out Raycast Pro. With Pro, you can take advantage of Raycast AI to summarize text in any app and translate text on the fly. It doesn't just stop there. It can do so many different cool things throughout your computer. One cool new extension they offer for this is AI Commands. AI Commands let you encapsulate a prompt into a command that you can run directly through Raycast. It's kind of like scripting for AI, but without really writing any code. One cool thing they also added to enable that is the use of dynamic snippets. That's just a fancy word for variables that Raycast keeps track of that you can use in your prompts. So you can use things like the date, the selected text, or a few other different things to make writing your AI commands more powerful. It also gives access to their Cloud Sync feature that helps you keep your settings in sync across all of your devices. To learn more about Raycast, you can head over to raycast.com, or you can go listen to episode 38 where we interviewed the CEO Thomas about the product, why they started, and where they're going with it. Would you like to advertise with DevTools FM? Head over to devtools.fm/subscribe. You want to not listen to these ads? Become a subscriber on one of the various platforms where we offer a subscription. So that would be Patreon, Apple, Spotify, you name it. And with that, let's get back to the episode.
That's wild. Before we dig into some of these other questions we have, I'm so curious, how do you do all the things that you do and not go absolutely insane? I mean, all right, let's go down the list, because I think just maintaining one like popular open source project can be really taxing and really time consuming. Maintaining a bunch, being on a board or several boards, having a family, which takes time. Yeah. And a startup. Yeah. Let's not forget that little fact. Like, how do you do it?
Okay. So first of all, I burned out badly from open source around the 2013, 2014 time. So I know what burnout is, and I know what I need to avoid doing to not get into that situation in that position. Okay. So that's the, that's probably the starting point for the, for this combo. Okay. If we want to have it, that's the starting point. So let's go through that. I'm going to take a little bit long form to get to the point. Okay. Back in those years, I was very active in the, I did my PhD in the Internet of Things. Okay. So part of how you do a lot of things is not a lot of time, is that you do a PhD and you build a lot of, you harden yourself a lot to work. Okay. And so you, this is formative, as they say. Okay. When I'm doing my PhD, I do a lot of research on that, and I ended up creating a MQTT broker called Mosca, and maintaining the primary MQTT driver for Node.js, MQTT.js. And with those two things, I ended up being in... what happened was that a company took my broker, paired it up with another open source project and another open source project, okay? So I have two browser in arms, essentially. They wrapped all those three projects, put a nice bow on it, and a lot of developer marketing on top of it, raised money, and sold it to and sold the company. So they raised a Series seed and then sold the company. This person does it as a job, okay? And at some point, it was filling up a lot of bugs and issues and questions on my repos. And I asked him, look, can you just start paying me, because I'm fixing all these bugs for you? You have raised money, whatever, man. I am in Italy and I'm just out of my PhD, whatever. I would love to make a living here. Okay. You're making money. So, you know, I'm not saying, he said no. And I burned out badly. Mostly because I took one of those projects. I took the point of, if there was a bug or an issue, I would fix it myself. Okay. And part of the reason why I can maintain so many modules and so many things, it's because I don't do that anymore. Like, I don't fix bugs for others. Okay. This is my starting point on any conversation is, either you fix your bug or you pay me. There is no in between those two things. Okay. You know, the only part where I'm fixing bugs for others is for Platformatic, my startup. So if somebody reports a bug, I fix it, but I'm paid to do it. Right. And very happy too, by the way. And if it's a security vulnerability, So if it's a security vulnerability, I typically step in and do the work that's needed to ship the fix, because I believe it's important. And that's kind of it. In all the other cases, I'm typically replying, hey, thank you for reporting this. Would you like to work on this issue? I am no shame in asking and doing all of that. And it's essentially, it's the only sane way for an individual to do that. And it also provides the best long-term maintenance strategy. Like, you need to consider that if you're building an open source project, you have a large number of people, which is you can call them the lurkers, the people that do not contribute, that do not show up, that, you know, they just use it. Okay. They are pure consumers. Okay. Then there are people that report bugs. And then there are people that fix bugs. Okay. Then there are collaborators that, you know, help with the triaging, reviewing the bug fixes and shipping releases and evolving the project, ideating new things and so on and so forth. And then you have, you know, the so-called project leadership or anything. And if you need to consider this as a pyramid when you're building a community-driven open source, okay, if you're doing a startup or some other stuff, you know, you have, if you have capital available, you can do things differently if you want to, okay? So it's, but if you're building a community-based open source, this is the way to go. And because you can share, so ultimately you want to share the governance, okay, with others. And if you have a company in place, you're already sharing the governance with the shareholders or whatever, right? But if you are building a community-based open source, then you want it to be, you want a large base and you want a lot of people, you know. The more collaborators you have, the merrier. The more triagers you have, the merrier. The more, you know, everybody should come in, please. It's, you want to help. So essentially, share the load with a lot of other people. And that's when and where things work. That's the TLDR.
I really resonate with what you said about, like, people asking for things of you. Like, I'm not nearly as prolific of a maintainer as you, but like on my projects, when someone's complaining about something, the words I've typed more than anything are PR's welcome. Like, if you have enough time to complain, you probably have enough time to go look in the code and fix it, because it's just JavaScript, you can fix it.
Pretty much, yeah. Well, yeah, that's the TLDR. Yeah, that's the gist. So I have no, there is also a kind that only pretends and asks, and then they say, oh, I will not use your library, I'm doing whatever, I'm forking, blah, blah, blah. And I am, you know, okay, fine, do it. Or, you know, I'm not fixing it. Like, this is not a tactic that does not work.
Yeah, it's a common one you want to go for. Even in my young career, I was like, oh, I'll threaten to leave. But it's like, please leave. Like, I didn't ask you to use my thing. You're just causing me more work. Feel free to go fork it and have your own work.
Pretty much, yeah. Well, there is people that take from the open source community without giving back. I tend to call them the vampires. Okay. And you don't want to be left to the vampires. Right? You. There is a good place. There's only one thing to do with vampires. So, you know, so just get rid of them. And you can call Buffy and you're good. Okay. So if you're old enough, you can laugh at this joke, but whatever. So it's basically, that's the solution with vampires.
I think, you know, this is a basic sort of empathy thing, but people just don't realize how much time and energy it takes to maintain, you know, a project. And when we think about the work context, you know, if you're a software engineer and you're paid to do something, you know, you're working on a team, you have like a feature in mind, you have a bug fix in mind or whatever, and you sort of have this continuous thing that's on a roadmap or whatever, and there's like a plan, and you got support system, and hopefully, you know, you get the resources you need to make progress. But in open source, it's like, you're doing this on the side, you're probably not getting paid for it. This is one of many, many responsibilities. you know, this is something that you started ideally because you wanted to, that you're interested in the problem or whatever. And every time you come back to it, you have to build up all this extra context just to figure out, like, okay, what was going on? Why did I do this? You know, why is it the way that it is? And they want it some way different. And then, you know, then balancing the decisions is like, this person wants this. Do I want to add this? Does it even make sense? You know, yeah, it's just like all that context. It's just like a lot of energy. It's a lot of energy, a lot of time. And people get overly privileged and just like want.
Well, yes, it's look, it's so bad. Okay, it's there's a highs and there are lows. Okay, so my career will not be there if I hadn't do all the open source that I've done and I didn't get massive results from the community. So on that, I am very grateful. Okay, on the other end, it's also a lot of responsibilities in here. So it's and you know, most of the time is no, don't. It's a gatekeeper. Like, most of the time is acting as a gatekeeper and saying no, and say no. Like the biggest answer is no. And from time to time, even say, no, I don't have the mental capacity now to review this code or review this change. Like literally very soon, somebody sent in a PR that literally rewrote a library that was working fine from using pure functions to use classes. And the test all pass still, but I am so worried of landing that change of what could break. So, and yeah, essentially, it's very hard on that front. Yeah. Also, tools change all the time. So to some extent, the lower your tool base is and the lower your tool chain footprint is, the better. So, and this is, you know, you see a few maintainers, quite a few actually, don't still publish their stuff, publish their modules in JavaScript, right? Author the modules in JavaScript, or use very old school test framework, or use as little, because all of like having a big tech stack increases dramatically the cost of updates. Okay, and having a small one, it's actually super. It's a breeze. Okay, why in an app we need all those things, and that's fine, and there are a lot of good trade-offs in maintenance. Having less work is the better. So if, you know, if my test framework changes and the new version does not run my old test, this is a massive problem. Okay, just to clarify the situation. Okay, sorry to be to diverge a little bit, but this is also the way certain of my projects are structured. What are they doing? It's done in a certain way.
So speaking of large communities with few contributors, you're also involved with Node.js a lot. What is your role at Node.js, and like what features have you helped shepherd?
Let me try to correct you. So how many people do you think are involved in developing?
If I had to guess, like active, like fully active, like, or just like occasionals, like monthly.
How many people do you think have the commit bit on Node.js?
There's probably been a lot of people who've made commits.
Hundreds?
Yeah, okay. Okay, hundreds. Okay, it's 120, something like that. And active, I think, between 30 and 50, I would say. It is a lot of traffic. There's also a huge amount of work to do. So I'm not, you know, it's a massive. Node.js is a project that runs on different combinations of operating system and CPUs architecture, something like 50 something different combinations, which it's a lot, all things considered. Like you can run Node on AIX, you can run Node on PowerPC, you can run Node on ARM, but not just ARM, the Max, that's one build. You can run on the ARM of your Raspberry Pis, which is a different build because, you know, it's different ARM. And there is ARM on Windows. You know that now there is ARM on Windows. So if you have a Windows binary, you can have the ARM Windows binary or the traditional Intel Windows binary. I think we also have the x86 32-bit and the 64-bit available in those platforms. You know, all Mac Intels, you know, there is a lot of builds to do. and a lot of operating system that we support. So on top of that, there are new features coming and bug fixes and updates in the platform and JavaScript and so on and so forth. So there is a lot of work on. And to be honest, we need more work. We need more volunteers. It's Node.js needs, it's, as you probably said correctly, it's understaffed. We have a queue of 1,400 issue right now with 562 PRs. So I am, a few of them are pretty old, okay? Like the oldest one of open PR is 2018. And, but there is a lot here, okay? There are a lot of open PRs that, might be we could probably close it, okay, right now. But I have just, there's a lot. That's what I'm trying to say, okay? It's a lot of work, and it takes some time to land a change because of all those question marks.
What do you find your capacity of contribution to be? I mean, is it mostly guidance?
Mostly guidance, yeah. I typically do three things, okay? Quite a lot of my contributions are on the security front. This is a time sink, okay? But this is actually time sink that is good. I do guidance code reviews for other people most of the time. And if I have a bug, I implement the bugs or I implement new features, okay? Like I think in around 2018 or something like that, I more or less drew some kind of a plan to make fetch happen in Node. And we just had, we'd actually be able to make Node fetch stable now. So I'm very, it's a milestone, okay?
It is a huge milestone. Yeah, that work is very much appreciated.
Well, to be honest, you should probably not use the fetch on Node.js to begin with. But if you really want to, it's there. Okay, people apparently really want it badly, so it's now there. Okay, way better alternatives than fetch, but people apparently loves that thing. So I am, we obliged and implemented it according as close to the spec as possible, which is which a lot of people didn't like. So this is the fun part. Oh, I want fetch, but it's the spec. Yeah, but it doesn't work like Node fetch. Yeah, Node fetch doesn't follow the spec. Oh, but I thought Node fetch was the spec. Okay.
Yeah.
So, it's these conversations are fun. Okay. So it's, but I'm personally new, but if we wanted to ship fetch, we'd ship the true thing, not Node fetch, which is a great module, by the way. It's fantastic. It's probably a better API than fetch. So, this is super. Super fun stuff. So,
so another fun topic in Node.js land is CJS and ESM. It's been a long road, lots of arguments about it online. What's your take on the current situation and how we might get out of it?
Okay. I am going to say something very, probably not controversial, but for a person that uses Node.js, okay, only on the server or on, or for scripting, okay, for build tools, it's a complete nuisance. Okay, nuisance, I don't know what's the right way. It's literally something that is only causing problems and only a source of frustration, okay? All those people don't care. They want stable tools. The end users want stable tools, stable libraries. All of this is just useless work for the sake of work, okay? This is the starting point of, really does it matter with ESM starts matter, the moment where you want to have libraries that are isomorphic and work both on the server and the front end, or both on the server and with bundlers. This is actually very important. So it's an important use case for Node. So this is where the ESM contention comes from. Also, it comes from the fact that a lot of full stack engineers want to use ESM both inside their bundlers and inside in Node.js itself, and want to use the same library in the same way. All of that is well much understood, okay? So the part of the biggest problem in ESM was that And when it was standardized without a reference implementation. And it did not deliver most of what the intent of that spec was, but now we are stuck with it. Okay. So essentially it's, you know, in theory, the proponents of ESM was, well, you don't need bundling anymore. Okay. Have fun. Okay. Oh, but you know, and then there is, oh, but you can just run it straight on your browser, but you're not running JSX to transform your React components. So what, you know, at that point in time, you could be writing ACME script and not ECMAScript, but ACME script, and you, whatever you write would be identical. Okay. You could be writing TypeScript and it doesn't matter, or TSX, and it doesn't matter at all because you are transpiling anyway. So what's the problem here? Okay, just to frame the problem, it's a little bit, that's part of the situation. However, that is the standard of JavaScript, okay? So at this point, that ship of saying, well, you don't really need this, because you don't, I'm sorry. Nobody will change my mind on you don't need it, okay? You don't need it. Okay, but on the other end, the trend is pretty clear. Node.js needs to support ESM as a first-class citizen, and it should become the default way of which people write Node.js in the future. So it's also a big ask from the community, maintainers, and everybody, and it's something that the project is going full steam on. There are a few things that are happening on that front. So first of all, the loaders are almost ready, are very stable now, the one that we have on 20. Once they hit stable, probably is the way, the moment where you really want to start writing backend applications with ESM. And I'm saying that, I'm not saying that lightly, that is actually very critical. Okay, loaders is the only way in which an application can become observable. Okay, all those APMs and observability toolkit relies on monkey patching. A lot relies on injecting probes somewhere. And in order to do so, they need to attach to the load process. Now, the fact that the loader were not stable means that that will not be reliable. Now, would you drive a car without a seatbelt on, or, you know, without the warnings, without the lights? You need to know what you're doing, okay? So it's so much better to drive a car that has the automatic braking system versus a car that does not have that, okay? So please, you know, it's people want those tools, okay? Backend engineers, backend system wants those tools. So that's critical. That's the first critical thing. So once that's getting stable, it opens up, oh, now ESM is probably a good citizen, and you can not be on the forefront. You can be, it's mass adoption time, okay? On the other front, we are, on Node.js, we are exploring a few things, okay? We are exploring the ways in which we can simplify a few things. So we have introduced, Node 21, we have introduced a new flag that you can test what an ESM word would be. So it flips the default, and now you enjoy the word. Okay, essentially, provide us the feedback of how this word look like for you, okay, and how are you getting on in an ESM first word, okay? This is a question for people. You know, try it out. Let us know what you think about that work. The second one, which is even more interesting, is we are currently exploring a few ways in which we could support both syntaxes on the same extension. Like the part of the problem is that TC39 in their massive source of wisdom decided to write a language specification that could not be that overlapped. So, and not have a use strict or a way to differentiate them very quickly. So in order, the only way in which you can differentiate between the two is by doing a full parse and executing the thing. But this was a massive mistake from my point of view. Okay, you want to be able to do it with one pass. But there are ways in which we could do that now that we couldn't at the beginning. do a very quick static analysis pass on the file and cover the majority of cases. And that could actually be enough. Like, for example, if you're using import at the beginning of a file, you're probably writing an ESM module, okay? If you are calling module.export equals something, it's probably a CJS module. It's very likely to be a CJS module, okay? Like, it's technically possible to still cheat the system a little bit, but it's, you know, a lot can be done on that front. And people are currently exploring ways in which we can implement those things in a good way, in a way that is still performant, but it solves, you know, it removes the ambiguity in your code, and that would be great.
Yeah, I was reading through some of the issues and pull requests around, like, the automatic mode is what I think you're talking about. And if that lands, like, I think that just kind of, like, solves all the issues. It's inspiring to see, like, Bun came out and, like, just was like, oh, we're going to do this. And it kind of, like, made, you don't think so?
No, it's not the problem of Bun. So, okay, the problem of Bun is Bun did what a few people said that Node should have done, which take the spec, wrap it in a nice piece, take the spec, wrap it in a nice ball of paper and throw it in the bin. And that was Bun is done. And look, I'm very much, you know, it's basically said, no, I don't give a damn about the spec. I just do what developer wants and that's it. So that's what Bun did, okay? You know, it's a respectful opinion, okay? And not an approach that Node.js, the team on Node.js would be willing to do, okay? Also, people involved in the spec and stuff said, no, please don't do this, okay? You know, if the approach of ESM module is to be compatible with the web, you don't want to be an hybrid that is a server hybrid, okay? Sorry, you don't do this, okay? This is, like, it's against the goal. Okay. Again, I just want to clarify that it's against the goal of having ESM in the first place. So if you are creating an hybrid, then it's not a good thing for the ecosystem. So that's one of the worst things that Bun shipped, by the way, from my point of view, because it has some bugs also. And it's basically the way ESM works. In ESM, you need to do a big linking step, which you collect all the information about all your modules, and then you run all the tree, essentially. And you resolve the tree. You link the tree completely at the beginning, and then you run the tree. And CommonJS instead works, oh, I'm executing this file, and then I'm executing the next one. So the two modules are fundamentally incompatible with each other. They cannot be mixed. And if you start mixing them, you are causing, you know, then you have a certain edge cases on loops of modules that don't work anymore. And quite a few modules out there do that. So, So this is my take. No, the reason it happened, it was the reason why that discussion went through was it's part of the road to ESM and the discussion, the group that have been pushing and developing ESM for all the past few years. I want to cite Geoffrey Boots and a few others, but Geoffrey and others, they are great. Okay. And they've been championing ESM, and it came from them. Like, at some point, we might want to make the switch. Okay. And then while we were exploring, this is why the new flag came in. And while we were exploring that flag and that switch, okay, we found a lot of problems with it, okay, to be honest. And that spurred, well, this does not seem viable. Like, it does not look to be viable. So if what do we need to do to reinvent a world where we can do both parsing both things, okay? And turns out that there were progress in other areas, okay, that unblocked this path. Okay, so this is, it might look like it's Bun related, but to be honest, it's not Bun related. This specific thing is not Bun related. Okay, so this is essentially the results of a lot of years of work from quite a small team. So I could, you know, chapeau to them, and I'm not taking any merit apart from finding out all the problems in that flag. So basically, my take here, that flag is, it is a lot of problems with an ESM first word. So a lot of tools are not compatible with it. That's the true sense. So probably don't want to do that, but we'll see. Okay. So hopefully we can get one of the two version that does automatic decisions on without looking at the code, without running the code, and can automatically pick. We can do them. If we can pick one, that's amazing. And then there are two competing PRs open, so I think one of them will probably land. So I don't see why not. Okay, so the biggest obstacle, I think, was kind of resolved. And I think once that ship, no blockers minus finding an implementation that's fast enough. So this is the question, okay? So the true blocker would be, if you probably are doing that, you will be probably seeing some lag and performance slowdown in the startup because of, you know, that. But at this point in time, if we can guarantee that that happens only when you are hitting the ambiguity path, okay, and you don't put your type module or your type common.js thing in your package JSON, I might be good into doing that.
I want to shift gears a little bit. I would really like to talk about Platformatic, but before we do that, it's probably good to talk a little bit about Fastify, given that that's an integral part of your company. So would you like to just explain briefly sort of like what Fastify is and sort of why you created it?
Fastify is a web dash API framework for Node. You typically use it to build your APIs. You can also render templates, render HTML, serve files, do web sockets, do a lot of very interesting things, support both HTTP and HTTP2, compare against some other frameworks, support both. It's maintained by, I think, 17 to 18 people now, something like that. So it has a good thriving community. It's at version 4. And how it differs to other servers, it's fast. Okay, it's as fast as Node is, essentially. Like our goal is, our unattainable goal is to be zero overhead compared to Node.js. It's not technically possible because it had some work on top. But yeah, we are doing that. Okay, we are trying to be there at the top. We are actually very close. Okay, so the what you lose for Fastify features, it's not much. Okay, it takes a few different approaches compared to Express, which is what everybody else is using. First of all, well, it's maintained. Sorry, Okay, it has ship releases regularly. Okay, it fixes bugs regularly. It accepts PRs regularly. It's a thriving project. Okay, it's not in this limbo that Express is, and especially super popular. It's a great project. But it does not have a thriving community of maintainers behind it. So I am, which Fastify has. So this is the first point. It also comes with the fact, if you have a bug, you come and fix it. So, you know, it's might be interesting for you. And it has a few other things. It has a different approach to routing, which makes it way faster, especially if you have a large project. It's significantly better, because it uses a little bit of data structures algorithm to do fast routing, thinking that, look, routes are actually a tree. Instead of like Express does, a list of regular expressions looped. Okay, so that's what our routing in Express does, is that looping over regular expressions. So if you're the one that matches is the last one, good luck. Which, you know, it's the most naive thing to do, but it's far from good. Then it does not monkey patch a score. Okay, so I am pretty much Node core, which is probably something pretty bad, and it means that it can be faster, but also it allows core to evolve. Okay, and you can just using public APIs is significantly better in this front. It has a logger embedded. We talked a little bit about Pino It's if you are doing logging in Node.js, you're not losing Pino, you're probably leaving money on the table in the front of server costs. So you might really want to use Pino. It's really flexible. It can be adapted to your logging needs. You need to know your logging needs to adapt it, of course. Okay, so it's I have a good video on YouTube that talks a little bit about logging. But essentially, logging, it's a side effect of your routes, okay, if you're writing a server, which is the worst kind of thing you want to have. You know, in school, they tell you functions should not have a side effect. Okay, they try to grill this to everybody? Function that logging is by what it is, it's a side effect of you executing a function. So it's and one that is unbounded. Okay, like nobody wants to slow down their application if the disk cannot keep up in logging. The disk you're logging to cannot keep up with the amount of logs. But this is a problem that people at scale have been seeing. So Pino has all facilities to deal with those things. Okay, and there it's amazing because it's used by quite a lot of companies out there that have massive logging needs and tools that all of you are using every day, essentially, are right now or this evening, you're probably using some of those tools that are logging with Pino at massive scale. So it's a very good logging library. So it's built in, okay? And those two things, this is actually very important. And it also have a plugin system because you want to have an ecosystem, but middlewares are not good because of the overhead cost. So we have plugins that are more complex API surface, but allows the same level of extensibility without monkey patching. So it's great. So essentially that's a little bit of overview of Fastify. From all intents and purposes, it looks a lot like Express in terms of APIs. It's been heavily inspired by it, to be honest. So I'm not going to say anything different here, but it's a different beast underneath. It's faster, support async await out of the box. You can do a lot of nice things with it.
Yeah, that's awesome. So what kind of things can you do with plugins in Fastify?
So something very interesting is Fastify is this, one of the technical principle is if something could be a plugin, it should. So we have added hooks everywhere to let people do everything, all sorts of possible things. Let me make a few examples. So one of the things that's very hard is starting up and shutting down a program. Now, why it's important? Because a lot of people tended to implement their server and using globals. And having the app is a global, the logger is a global, the database connection is a global, okay? And then when they started to write tests, everything fell apart because, how do I reset the global? Really? Are we doing singletons again? Okay. Didn't we learn anything from the languages that came before? So singletons are just one of the source of all evil. You don't want to have any live data or any live object attached to those. So so avoid them like hell. So because of that, because of the fact that we have, so Fastify, I have a startup and shutdown phase. With this startup and the plugin system is managed by this library called Avio. And then we have a hook to shut everything down. What does it mean? Well, it means that whenever you start something up, then you can unwind it. So if you start, you can say that you start a database connection when your server starts. And you shut it down when the server closes. What does this mean? Well, it means that you can use Fastify to implement some sort of auth reloading or rival reloading system somewhat easily, or it's possible at least, because you don't need to swap modules or do any crazy stuff. You just say, I can just start the server, stop the server, restart, it's done. Okay, it's not a lot of work, okay? Well, it is a lot of behind the scene to set it up correctly, but it's not impossible. Some other stuff that we added is WebSockets. Okay, so with WebSockets, the WebSocket plugin have a P piggyback on the router of Fastify to implement routes for WebSocket. You know that WebSocket have routes, okay? If you knew, there's WebSocket have routes, so you can have a multiple WebSocket connection with different handlers, and Fastify support that too. So it's great. So these are a few examples. Then we go from there to file system-based routing. It's possible with a plugin to CSRF protection. You know, if you need that, you probably need CSRF protection, even though you think you don't, but you probably need it, you know, just saying. And that kind of stuff, okay? So down to, you know, implementing event loop protection, which is a phenomenal thing that everybody should be doing and should be the default in all your apps. But most people don't even know that that exists or that's a problem. So I've recently done a talk at AspreConf in Europe to talk about this. I'll probably post a video sooner rather than later on social.
So Fastify seems like it's a very like unopinionated, you can make it do whatever you want. But your service that you built on top of it, Platformatic, is what I've heard you describe it as, very opinionated. So what is Platformatic and what are those opinions that it brings along?
Okay, so you can build a lot of things with Fastify, okay? It's similar to Express. It comes with more opinion than Express, but not too many. So for example, it bundles in a logger, okay? You know, that's a major one, okay? It bundles in a logger. It's like, this is a logger, okay? Logging, everybody does logging. It's a first-class concern of a framework. So yeah, this is the logger, okay? And it does plugins, it does hooks, but it's very unopinionated in the way you structure your projects, okay? This is the first problem. But it's also because we wanted to have a very large contributor base, okay? So we want to be able to attract people that care for the most disparate usage of Fastify. So, yay! Okay? Please come. So that's Fastify, okay? However, there is quite a lot of other problems that Fastify does not have a strong opinion on. How do you manage config in your application? Okay? This is bad. Okay? Most people do config so bad that their application becomes unmaintainable as a result of their config choices. I don't know why. Like, I am very keen on knowing, okay? But yeah, again, we took that choice, that thing, as a good starting point for something. Then we have, it has embedded the ability, it embeds quite a lot of the Fastify ecosystem. So Fastify, there's the main Fastify project and maybe 50 plus public modules, public plugins that we maintain. And Platformatic builds on top of those public modules, plus something in the ecosystem too. So it collates all of them together, so you don't need to think of, oh, I need the event loop protection plugin. Oh, I don't need the OpenAPI plugin. I don't need the GraphQL plugin. I don't need the route level, the file system-based routing to set up, okay? I don't need to think on how I structure my unit test, how I structure my folders, okay? How I configure everything up, okay? Platformatic does all of these out of the box, okay? It comes with batteries included, okay? This is what we call Platformatic Service, okay? Then on top of it, we have a tool called Platformatic DB. Platformatic DB is, it uses Platformatic Service. But on top of that, it also had an automatic SQL to REST and SQL to GraphQL CRUD system, so that you can just run your migration, point it to a database, it explores the database, runs the queries, and then it creates the routes and resolvers and GraphQL for you automatically, which is fantastic because it can shed a lot of time in that. We also have an automatic client for calling microservices. So this is a typical usage of Fastify. I'm building microservices, but then if you build microservices, you have one server that calls Andrew's microservice that calls Justin microservice. And each one of us needs to write a client. Okay, mine's Justin because he's lucky. And he does not call anybody. But I need to write a client, and Andrew needs to call a client, write a client. Which, what does this mean in practice? It means that a lot of time is being burned in writing those clients. And in fact, what we have done is we have an embedded client system. So you can just say, oh, this is a URL, and we can generate some types for you. But also, more importantly, you can get a client already built in the system that also support all the OpenTelemetry headers out of the box. So another thing that we do in Platformatic, there is OpenTelemetry support built in, and which is great, okay? We have a composer system that is built on top that allows you to compose multiple services into one. Using REST now, OpenAPI and REST, and in the future, GraphQL. We also invented a way, and this is phenomenal, but not a lot of people is bothering us on that. It's to run multiple Fastify servers inside the same process and have them auto-reload and live-reload separately, and having them composed as a single endpoint. It's actually phenomenal to see, because you can have 3, 4, 5, 10 microservices running in the same process, greatly simplifying building that the modular monolith thing, greatly simplifying the way things are deployed and set up, especially for small teams. So it's I think it's amazing from my point of view. Okay, I've not seen anything. We have been dog fooding it for the development of our closed source tools, so it's which is great, okay, and it's fantastic. Like, the developer boost is fantastic, okay. Like, it's we have this we can implement things in no time almost now with this tool, because everything is already figured out. So it comes with batteries included, so a lot less to think about. You know, done. It's already there. So we could use for better docs, but this is, we're working on it.
That reminds me of like module federation. There's some exploration of like being able to break down larger front-end apps into different modules that all get like spliced together into, you know, one front-end app. And this modular approach to sort of, you're building microservices, you're thinking about it microservices and you're authoring it, but you're deploying it like a monolith, which is kind of a cool approach.
Yeah, it's pretty nice. It's pretty interesting.
So what is the sort of monetization model of Platformic? You're based around a lot of open source tooling. You have like some configuration and some good defaults sort of out of the box. So how do you monetize the product?
Oh, okay. So the open source part stays open source. Okay. We are not planning to make any changes, or even can make any changes there. Like, I don't want to talk about too much about legal open source stuff, but you know, things were put in place to avoid relicensing issues. So the open source parts stay open source. They are Apache 2, so we'll stay open source. How are we monetizing it? In a few ways. So first of all, we have a closed source. So we have developed Platformatic Cloud that you can use to deploy any Fastify or Platformatic application, or even Express application, to the web. Okay. It has tires and so on and so forth. So that's one of the ways. Then the other way we have, we sell support contracts for Platformatic. So which is, it's traditional open source business model to some extent. We have also one component that's part of our cloud. Though our cloud, you can also take our cloud and run it on-prem. So we have an enterprise version that can fully run on-prem. I don't know how many of you have worked on on-prem software and how hard it is to find good automation there. You can take that and, run it on-prem. And it's very nice because you can get a lot of things for free. Well, not for free. It's a paid product, but you get it. You get at a fraction of the cost that will take to develop it yourself. Okay, this is the gist. Last but not least, we created a new algorithm to be able to automatically detect the risk that a pull request is going to break your production system. And we have even published a white paper on it on Arxiv, a month ago or something. So we've written this algorithm. I have a PhD on code. And it's we have written this algorithm with a lot of simulations and science and you know analysis around it, and it's we give you a risk analysis and a number, okay, which typically is, well, we think this is going to break your production by in the 20% of the cases. It's probably too high, or you probably want to cut to verify it by hand, okay? Oh no, this is not going to break production. Okay, yeah, and maybe I can ship it, okay, with in a more relaxed way, okay. But the one that breaks, you know, 20% of the cases, maybe probably do it better, man. Okay, so you know, probably want to, you know, verify it all. The nice part is that system works with live data from OpenTelemetry, so and it's not, so it does not work on a closed world model, but it works from live production data. So it can even identify and know that a service is using this API that you do not know about, which is the typical case of production breakages in microservice system.
Yeah, that's really awesome. I saw that in your 1.0 announcement video, and I think that's an incredible value add because this is, you know, this is something we all face. So there's a few things that you talked about that are really cool. I mean, I think we do end up making interfaces between services a lot, like spending a lot of time writing on those, and then also making a breaking change without realizing it's a breaking change and bringing something down accidentally. That's unfortunately common.
Typically is not even like typically, you know, that somebody is using your API, so you send a message to them and say, look, I'm going to deploy this to production. Please change your client or something, okay? So you coordinate with them, you do the release with the two things at the same time. And then somebody else is using the same API and you don't have a clue. So that's the most nightmarish scenario that you can. And that is typically billing. And now you have your CEO at your door, if off your house, with a pitchfork to try to, you know, I don't know. This is the situation is pretty bad.
Yeah, revenue impacting is never good.
Revenue impacting bugs, yes, because that's typically the case for the small, tiny service that keeps everything alive.
Okay, so now that we're wrapping up here, we like to ask like a future-facing question, looking out in the future. So for you, I think a good question to ask is, what do you think the future of JavaScript runtimes is? I feel like now we're in like kind of this like, there's a lot of activity going on. There's Bun, there's Dino, nodes doing stuff. So what do you think the future of it all is?
Okay. We have nice Swagger platform, I think. So we're nice bottles. Can I put it here? Let me see if I can. Yay. Here it is. Platform mat. Nice one. So sorry, I'm joking. I'm drinking some water. Sorry. That's a tough question.
Stalling, I see.
So the solution, so the future of runtime. Okay, so the main concern is and should be the openness of the platform, okay? It's, I learned HTML and CSS and JavaScript by looking at the source code of pages. You know, that is critical, okay? Keeping the platform hackable and keep the platform very easy to get started and so on and so forth with. And I'm somewhat like scared what a future of, you know, if you heard about the original Dino announcement where they did a lot of jokes on, we are, not his dad type of thing. Okay. Luckily they were not right, but you know, there was a lot of jokes running, not too much from them, but from the community. And right now, even when Bun came out, it's a drop-in replacement for Node. And there was a recent meme that went around from somebody says, well, it's a drop-in replacement as much as a chair is a replacement for a sofa. So it's a drop-in replacement, right? You can sit on it and not the same thing. Okay. So, the problem with those is ultimately they are company products, okay? And I think it's totally okay for meta level, meta frameworks, high level components to be product based products, okay? Mostly because they require they are user facing and they are easy to monetize, okay? Languages, runtimes, fundamental things usually tend to be very hard to extract, harder to extract value from because they are not user facing, okay? And because of that, there is a risk of those things going private or we not being open source anymore, okay? So if this is probably a word where node stop existing is a word of commercial software, okay? It's not a word of open governance and collaboration, okay? And on the other end, bright side, all the frameworks have given phenomenal stimuli on Node to improve and ship faster and show pain points and be able to explore new directions which Node cannot afford to explore, okay? And especially on certain performance trade-off that Bun is doing, okay? To, you know, it's actually, you know, some of those are really phenomenal. So it came out with Bun install being super fast. And turns out that it's super fast because it's doing a lot less, okay? You know, it's which, you know, oh, look, is this a viable trade-off, okay? If you are willing to not have the latest version of your dependencies, you might get away with what you have on disk, and therefore we cannot call the internet, therefore saving a lot of install time. Okay, sorry to be. And this is really fundamental. It's a good Jared is a really good performance engineer. Okay, and he did a good work here, identifying those things, and he shaped something that is incredibly fast with different trade-offs. Now, are those trade-offs something that the community likes? If they are, then you know those things can be spread. Maybe as just options. Okay, that you can turn on and turn off if you want them in other tools. Okay, now there was some benchmark showed, oh, this is like 20 times faster, 30 times faster, something like that, which in reality it's not because it's doing two different things. And if you are putting them, the PMPM has some flags that more or less do the same thing. And if you squeeze them, it's still a few couple of times faster, but one maybe completes in 200 milliseconds and the other one 800 milliseconds, which it's, you know, a lot less appealing of than switching from a tool that takes from 20 seconds to 200 milliseconds, okay? Like something like that, okay? Which is, you know, there was 100 times faster, something like that. Well, yeah, this is doing nothing. Okay, so you cannot, like the numbers was telling that there was some major difference there, okay? And the major difference is in the caching. Like, again, and it's a great experimentation, okay? The other thing that Dino experimented on that is great is the fact that dependencies can be served from without a registry, okay? Turns out that probably that was not a great idea, okay? Because in the end, they had to support, ended up to support NPM. So it's... you're still using their imports and stuff. They have their proxy that is done with them, but they still have to, they ended up supporting all of NPM, okay? Which it's a single point of failure owned by GitHub, Microsoft, and so on and so forth. Probably not great from a community perspective. So the word that they describe would be much better if we just use URLs. It has some problems, okay? So it's, but again, that is great, okay? So, and then there is Cloudflare Workers with a completely different execution model, which is fantastic. I love Workers, okay? and they are very specific for something, and it's a great tool. So all of those combined creates us some interesting ways in which, you know, they're pushing node and in different direction all the time, renewing an effort on performance, for example, and or redoing an effort on on security on the other end. You know, there's all those things that are very important. So node is doing them. And I'm pretty glad that those other runtime exist to push node and create competition, because for a few years, node was a little bit stagnant to some extent. And it was hard to ship a lot of stuff. To be honest, there was a lot of technical debt to be cleaned up in some cases. So there still is. It's an old project. Okay. But I think things are significantly better now. So, and things are progressing very smoothly, I think.
Yeah, this is something I appreciate about the flourishing ecosystem, because it is like a, you know, a rising tide lifts all ships. I think that, like, you know, so when Bun came out, I think it helped push Dino in a direction of thinking more about compatibility. And then I think that they both had a positive influence on Node. And like you're saying, there is this value of having some external project do something that you can't do. So like Node, you know, being really close to standards and that being important is tremendously valuable for stability in the ecosystem and for compatibility. But there are some times where you think it's like, oh, well, if we could like not do some of this, what would that look like? And then having another frame, like another tool out there to do it. And you're like, oh, well, it works in this case, and it really doesn't work in that case. And like, you know, if nothing else, that's educational, right? It like lets you see, it's like, oh, so these are the sort of trade-offs that emerge in that world. And I think that is just valuable for the ecosystem, because it like, otherwise it's hard to even imagine what the possibilities are without someone like taking the chance to sort of not only build it, but like, you know, actually deploy it to production. So it is kind of interesting to see that world evolve.
Cool. Yep. It's a fun, brave new world to some extent.
We just need the stewards of V8 to continue investing.
Pretty much, yes. We have the Google overlords and the Apple overlords to keep releasing versions of that, of those libraries. Okay. They are open source. So they are open source. And I think let me check the V8 license. So V8 seems a form of BSD or something like that. I don't know. It's a very simple license. Okay. So unless we change, things change. Okay. It's very hard for us to, if V8 became closed source, yeah, well, probably there would be a fork. Okay. It's very likely that it will stall the development of new features of the language, essentially, and so on. So it's, I don't think they would, to be honest. I think they benefit too much from V8 being open source than anything else. So
yeah, I just, you know, I'm to the point now where, no offense to any people working at Google who might be listening to this, but I don't have a lot of faith in Google not killing things.
It's a cash cow. Okay. So the only key question here is they decided to make it closed source, but I think there are so many people in Google that like Chromium and that they want their system to be run on Linux systems. And they like the Chromium tree, the Chromium line, and so on and so forth, that I don't expect Google Chrome to stop being, like, to Chromium stopping being an open source project, okay? Even though it's corporate open source, okay, in that sense of there's not open governance. To be honest, though, with Microsoft stepping in and doing, you know, they doing co-maintenance and so on and so forth with Edge, maybe this is a good sign. Okay, you have two big techs working on the same stuff. It's very, you know, I don't see it going down and becoming and disappearing anytime soon.
Okay, with that, I think we'll wrap up the episode today. We'll skip tooltips. Thanks for coming on, Matteo. This was a fun talk about all things Node and all the great work that you do ecosystem. So thanks.
Thank you, folks. Thanks for having me. Bye-bye.
Yeah, it was really great having you on, Matteo. And I'm excited to see how Platformic evolves. It seems like a cool product. Good luck with the startup, and I hope it continues to do well.
Fingers crossed.